So I'm going to move on from Philip's look at investing in a sort of more formal area of markets, in terms of stock market. I'm actually going to look at dodgy finance, a much grayer area, where investing activity tends to be referred to by more formal financial actors as speculating, because there's always supposed to be a difference between being an investor and being a speculator. And it's sort of the next progression of work that I've been doing. For the first few years of my research, I've been looking at how trust is produced in financial markets, and now this is sort of the next step, looking at risk. So I wanted to start off with the way that risk is spoken about more rationally in finance. For those of you who have a mortgage and maybe some disposable income, you've maybe had a sit down with the bank, I never have, but maybe you have, and talked about investing in, I don't know, an ISA in Britain, something similar. And they ask you a whole set of questions about your investment experience, your age, your income, your risk tolerance, your investment time frame, and then they start to categorize you into your risk profile. Mm. And then you come out with your own tailored sort of full-color printout, and, you know, that's you. Mm-hmm. You've done your own little financial psychometric text. But I want to contextualize that a bit, because I've always had a problem with this sort of risk profile. I've helped to write this sort of thing myself when I worked in finance, because it never sort of spoke to me in terms of the way that I thought about risk growing up in a developing country. Because the whole premise of this kind of profile is that really frustrating word from economics, all things equal, ceteris paribus. And really in life, all things are usually unequal. So they don't take into account whether you've ever had your house burned down, whether you've, you know, experienced a tsunami, etc. So I'm going to move you through from UK and rational talks about investment and risk profile to Jamaica, which is where this particular story is located. What you're looking at here is a very typical street in inner city Kingston. Jamaica has a population of about 3 million, probably twice that living outside the country. And Kingston's significant because more than half the population live in Greater Kingston. So really it is a very urbanised population. And it's not so much that it's classified as a poor nation, but what it's always been significant for economists about the Jamaican economy is the levels of inequality. It's one of the starkest measures of inequality in the world and has been for several decades. And there are grand narratives in the Caribbean and indeed in other developing countries about debt. So when you're looking at your marker these days, Andreas, Jamaica's view would be, is our debt to GDP ratio worse than Greece? Because really that's now become the benchmark. And for a long time it was better. So, you know, you felt pretty good. And then there are narratives of development as well, you know, very constant conversation about development. But come the 1980s, that begins to change. Jamaica has its equivalent of what Britain calls a big bang, an opening up of the economy and finance, and you start to see lots of business press emerging, and you see lots of conversations about people being recast. They're not citizens necessarily anymore, they're not necessarily consumers, they're also now investors. So increasingly people are starting to think about themselves that way. At the same time, when I think about risk for the average Jamaican, I also have to look at external factors that also have an impact on their lives. And some of these include changes in policy. For example, the United Kingdom reinstating visas a few years ago in the 2000s, which cut off a very important safety valve for people who had no economic opportunity but could migrate to a country like the United Kingdom. And the United States, sometime after 9/11, really started to come down very hard on people who had green cards. So you could find yourself traveling in and out of the country, as many Jamaicans did, with a green card, and have it either confiscated or you'd be told that the next time you re-entered, you had to become a US citizen or you couldn't have a green card anymore. So that then puts another valve has been cut off, leaving more and more people trapped in a situation where they have no economic opportunity. And I think that's quite important. The third thing that begins to happen once the credit crunch sets in 2007, is the remittance economy, which for many people was the third largest part of GDP. By remittance, I mean people sending money via Western Union from other countries. This was a very, very important part of the economy that was propping up, say, people with working class backgrounds, poor backgrounds, lower middle income. That then is another valve that gets turned off. So I was talking about the inequality. This is Beverly Hills, Kingston, and it's not even the poshest neighborhood in Kingston. And that pressure really works throughout society because the visa implications, green cards, etc., that affects people who have lots of money as well. But one big change for people at this end of the market is electronic changes, things like the internet come. And you can start becoming an internet trader. So you can start involving yourself in things like the global currency markets. Isn't that exciting? Now you're behaving like a real first world investor. This is very important. And it's particularly important after the domestic financial sector collapsed in the 1990s because then people had to look for other routes to get investment return. Enter a huge increase in what are called investment clubs. I'm going to call them investment clubs for now. That's not what they turned out to be. But for now, we're going to call them investment clubs. Many of them were supposedly informal currency trading clubs, and the largest were closely associated with charismatic churches. And two in particular had real financial credibility because they were run by people who used to work in the formal financial sector and had sort of star status. So the one I'm going to talk about today is Cash Plus. And it started off in about 2000, hundreds and thousands of investors. And typically, like many of the clubs at the time, they were paying you a 10% monthly return. So no matter how much you put in, you could depend at the end of every month to go and collect your 10% earnings. Yeah. Wow, who wouldn't want to be part of that? It would be stupid not to. And according to some of the research, some of these clubs were giving you an annual return of 728%. That's how good it could be. I'm very struck by Kreesh's work on South African schemes. He talks about them being a field of schemes that are a field of dreams. And there is a great deal of conversation that you can find when people look at investing and speculating, where they talk about how they could achieve dreams. There's a sort of a yearning involved. Which brings me on to the data set. And what's quite interesting about this, I'm looking at online financial chat rooms. And if you compare this with some of the presentations we heard earlier today, where it's very relational, people are thinking about themselves in terms of partners, part of a couple, or part of a family. People don't tend to speak that way in financial chat rooms. It really is about me, the self, and making sense of the self. So Sproul and Ariaga are quite useful in this. They've done a lot of work on sense making online. I've used Carl Weick as well. And the other thing that's interesting is that people turn to these chat rooms initially for education, no matter what level of investing expertise they see themselves as having, because they want to share knowledge in the hope that they're going to get that kernel, you know, that sort of informal knowledge or information that will allow them to make a better investment return. Of course, with a plethora of clubs opening up, the regulator starts to get very interested in this. And I'm continually interested as I work through finance that even though regulators are technically part of the government, they're often at odds with the political directorate to the point where they almost appear to be sworn enemies. And certainly this is what happens in the terms of these clubs because everyone is investing in them. We know this now because of the investigations that have taken place. But members of parliament, even ministers of government, were invested in them. Heads of media houses were invested in them. And so there was a great deal of support at the very highest levels of society for, as one minister called it, ending financial hegemony of banks and allowing everyone to enter a new era of financial freedom was a term that he used. So the regulator starts to clamp down on some of these schemes. And Cash Plus was one of them, run by a man called Carlos Hill, who, as I said, used to work in the financial sector. So I turn now to these financial communities where people are trying to make sense of what these organizations actually are, what investment is, what the difference is between speculating, and whether it's worth the risk. So the person hosting this WordPress blog, who is anonymous as are all the users, puts up sort of his or her take on what Cash Plus is. It has become, he says, the poor man's financial messiah. But to some, it's a ticking time bomb. And you find this continually through this through these chat rooms, is a contrast between here's one point of view and here's another. It's not a definite bias saying you must do. Here are two points of view. All right. So the first sort of theme that I see coming out is different perspectives of victimhood. So on the one hand, you can see the investment clubs themselves being made victims. You know, the banks are trying to shut them down, the regulators are trying to shut them down, the United States is trying to shut them down. Stop trying to shut down the only organizations that are trying to help the people and to develop the economy. And also you see people talking about themselves as victims, and they're talking about themselves as victims in a very historical sense. So thank God for Cash Plus. And while their business exists here in Jamaica, it will enable most Jamaicans, including myself, to stop being a slave to the lender, which most of us are. And a second theme coming out is that of expertise. And this is quite well documented in literature on chat rooms. Two kinds of expertise I see coming out here. Life expertise, where people talk about risk. So Deborah, it has nothing to do with being educated. Life itself is a risk. And many rich persons who made it to the top have taken great risks. You know, why not me too? It's up to the individual if they choose to risk their money. I have decided to risk mine. If I lose it, so be it. And so on. But there's another kind of expertise coming out, and that's investment expertise, where there are people coming onto these chat rooms to warn you that these could be scams, that they can't be currency traders because currency trading does not give you high return. It couldn't possibly pay out 10% per month. So, you know, think. As I mentioned earlier, a strong sense of yearning when it comes to talking about investment. What could be if only I were an investor? So this person talks about, do you think the person who started out in year one with Cash Plus, with 1 million a year, is now regretting it? I don't think so. Was that person greedy? I don't think so. Are you not a bit jealous? And almost a sense of conspiracy theory as well. Someone responding to one of the investment experts who's calling Cash Plus a scam. Well, okay then. Why don't you teach us how to invest? If you can't, then let us take our own risks. So if you're not here to educate, Mr. US, go away. The rest of us are going to just have to learn by ourselves. And another person talking about the foreign exchange market is not a scheme, and pointing out, and I'd say, you know, probably quite correctly, that if you're going to call these schemes speculating, there's heaps of speculating that goes on in the formal side of the economy as well. Look at Bank of America. It speculates every night in the foreign exchange markets. Do people call that illegal? No. And the point being, I think we brought the point up earlier that there is very little distinction on the overlap between the formal and the informal economy. And I find this over and over again looking at Ponzi schemes, because the people invested in these schemes have bank accounts. The banks benefit a great deal from the money passing through these schemes because they have to pass through the banking system at some point. So how do you differentiate between the illicit and the legal? So that brings me to the end of, as I said, just a start of a work in progress, thinking about how people make sense of risk. Ultimately, for me, what I felt uncomfortable with looking at the rational discussions about risk, say, in UK finance, is that there's much more pressure on how we make risk decisions every day. They are culturally contextual. They're event contextual as well. So I think that sort of thing needs to be figured into the way that we talk about risk. Because in the end, this needs to be considered, because when these Ponzi schemes collapsed, it wasn't just individual lives that were affected. Jamaica's debt-to-GDP ratio went from something like 134% to 168%. So regardless of whether you're invested in the schemes or not, you are affected today. So.
Greg, who's got a question? Yeah, Shireen, then Andrea.
Yeah, thank you. It's so interesting. I'm just wondering where the regulator was during all this.
Bleating, day in, day out. I mean, it must have been the most thankless job ever to have had. They did their job, and the politicians prevented them from shutting down the seams when they should. And when the irony is, when they went in to do things like investigations, so they'd perform a raid, on the day that a raid happened with one of the big schemes, suddenly there were queues around the corner of people trying to invest in the scheme. Because the thinking was, if the regulator thinks something's wrong, then that, my God, that return must be even better than I thought. Which seems, yeah, it seems counterintuitive. And the end of the story is that the Jamaican regulator has never been allowed to take any of these, even any of the locally based schemes to the Jamaican courts. So eventually what one of the regulators did of her own accord was to pass over all her documents to a regulator based in Florida. And one of the schemes was then prosecuted in Florida and they found her sent to jail there. Cash Plus has never been indicted in Jamaica. Yes.
Incredible.
Yes.
Andreas?
Yeah, my question was somehow like that. I think the fantastic example, I enjoyed it very much. But my question was around, is it a registered business in Jamaica or is it placed in some other, on servers in some other country?
Yes, so they're registered in every way. They looked like a formal financial institution. There were branches. You would go in and have formal customer service. And actually what many people used to say over time was that the customer service was far, far better than the bank. I mean, they would have you sit down in a very comfortable chair. They would give you a cup of tea. You would get biscuits. You don't get that in regular banks anymore. You would get printed out statements. They would be emailed to you every month. In every way, they looked formal, but they weren't regulated. Despite the regulator insisting that they should come into the regulatory fold, they all refused to do that. So they took that decision not to become regulated. And, you know, that's because eventually, as it turned out, they were Ponzi schemes.
Mm-hmm. And so you could come there with two Jamaican...
Yeah, the minimum investment was, I think during 2007-08, about $10,000 Jamaican, which is a few hundred pounds. So even though it's presented as the way out for the poor, it really wasn't poor people who were invested. The other interesting thing I found looking at a number of these schemes was that many financial institutions were invested in them as well. Because, you know, that's what market speculators do. If there's 10% return going around, fine. But they're just thinking, well, I can get out before the scheme collapses, so I will. They didn't all do that, though. Yeah.
Thank you. That's very interesting. Just an observation, really, but in terms of some of the themes that you picked up from the bulletin board, when I did my PhD work on investors, very much the same, why do I want to be an investor? Because, you know, in the future I can live wherever I want, you know, I can sit by the swimming pool, and, you know, there's all this kind of promise, and just need to get it quite right. And also the justification of, well, is that that's what the investment banks do all the time.
Yes,
and
it's very common.
This sort of being set up against the big guys who are necessarily bad, and that therefore for gives a certain license or encouragement.
Yes, if the little guy engages in that kind of behavior, then it's resistance and it's right as a result. Yes.
So there are all sorts of commonalities.
Yeah.
I am reminded of something very similar in a very different context. I don't know if anyone knows the virtual world of Second Life,
the one
that's in the newspapers all the time. Mm-hmm. Second Life's banking sector was actually Ponzi schemes. Their entire banking sector, run by the people in this virtual world, not by Linden Lab, was a series of elaborate Ponzi schemes.
I didn't know that.
And the disintegration of banks in Second Life prompted a kind of moral crisis, and I've been sitting here looking at those signs and thinking about the kinds of protests that took place in Second Life, which were quite evenly split again between those residents who said, no, bring us back our banks, despite the fact that the people who ran them had run off with the cash to another country.
Yeah.
And then other people were saying, well, it could have never worked in the first place. Look at those returns. And again, going back to those two points of view on the bulletin board, but more of a comment than a question. Sorry about that.
But when did that take place?
That was around 2008-ish.
Mm-hmm.
The big peak of the first collapse was probably 2007, which is running along the same time
as
the world economic
collapse. Everyone was looking for alternatives.
Yeah.
I mean, you said it's not a question, but I thought of something I didn't mention in the presentation regarding Jamaicans' relationship with the formal banking sector.
Mm.
When I first encountered these schemes, I was extremely judgmental. I mean, I had no research question. My question was, are you mad? But as friends and family started to explain to me how hard it was to actually have a relationship with a formal bank, and this is primarily because of US anti-money money laundering legislation, where people like my sister, who doesn't have a 9-to-5 job, cannot get a credit card. You cannot get a credit card in Jamaica unless you have concrete assets.
Mm-hmm.
You can't even get a secured card like American Express, which you put cash on. They won't even take that. It has to be concrete assets, like a house or a car. So that means there's a whole swathe of economically middle-class people who cannot be part of the banking sector anymore.
Mm.
So having realized that, I just thought to myself, well, you must be crazy not to go to the alternative economy then, because the formal economy has basically given you the finger.
Mm.
And there's nothing about that in the risk profile in the financial institution.
Yeah, that was going to be my probably two or three more minutes, but a question to kind of get back to this issue of, you know, kind of economic sort of thought about risk or about kind of taking those kind of contexts into account, because I mean that's just frankly astonishing, really, the kind of that inaccessibility of banking, and in other parts of the world we can see how that is kind of changing with sort of new payment systems, and you know, there's a whole bunch of ways in which beginning to see responses to that, financial capability initiatives and blah blah blah, but this is another consequence of a lack of financial inclusion.
Yes,
right?
exactly. And I mean, inclusion, that I've seen this play out over and over again, knowing my history better than necessarily other countries' histories, but I remember during the 1970s the number of people who couldn't afford to farm anymore, and then surprise surprise they turned to growing marijuana. You know, well, it grows really nicely in between sugarcane, first and foremost. And we get a better return. We can't sell our sugarcane. What do you want us to do?
Mm.
And so they went through that whole sort of scenario again. They weren't criminals. They were just trying to make a living as farmers. So whenever you take away people's access, and it's enacted by governments. In the case of the anti-money laundering legislation, it's backed by the IMF. It's backed by the OECD. And they wonder why developing countries don't become developed. Actually, they don't wonder.
Mm-hmm.
They're keeping you there.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Any final questions? Okay, great. Thanks.